Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. On the show today, we bring you the first part of the American story, The Murders in the Rue Morgue, by Edgar Allan Poe. We also have a report from Brian Lynn about a new Turkish law. Later, I talk about fantasy football in America. But first, Susan Shand looks back at the life of Robert Mugabe. The longtime leader of Zimbabwe died Friday.
Robert Mugabe became the leader of the newly named country of Zimbabwe in 1980. That year, the nation won its long fight against British colonialism. The formerly white-ruled Rhodesia and its new leader quickly became the pride of southern Africa. Its farm economy was so successful that it became known as the breadbasket of the area. But white people, who were 5% of the population, owned nearly 75% of agricultural land. In trying to solve this problem, a once well-respected Mugabe government changed. Over almost 40 years as its leader, Mugabe's rule became widely considered corrupt and murderous. The former president died on Friday at the age of 95, 2 years after being forced to give up power. Amnesty International says that he left behind a non-removable stain on his country's human rights record. The human rights group said Mugabe's early years as a leader saw national improvements in health care and education. But as he grew at ease with power, his government began murdering political dissidents. His land reform program was deeply corrupted as well. This led to the collapse of the Zimbabwean economy. Muleya Mwana Nyanda is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Southern Africa. He said Mugabe caused lasting damage for Zimbabwe's people. In 2008, the country experienced a hyperinflation that rose above 500 billion %. Those living in the capital city of Harare now find themselves in some of the worst conditions of their lives. There is no running water. There are long lines to buy very costly bread. Millions have emigrated from the country over the years. We were promised Canaan, Dadirai Chakai of Harare told the Associated Press earlier this year. But this is hell, he said. Mugabe and many others believed land reform was required to fully end Zimbabwe's racist colonial past. At the time of the country's liberation, a small number of wealthy white farmers owned 75% of the country's farmland. But the president's plan became a lawless move to gain power and wealth for himself, his family, and his political supporters. At first, white farmers refused to sell their land when the government did not offer full value. Land reform stalled. Members of the pro-Mugabe War Veterans Association started to seize white-owned farms under what came to be known as the Fast Track Land Reform Program. For the economy, it was the beginning of the end. Over the next years, the economy fell 40%. Zimbabwean money became worthless. Foreign investment fled. The land seizures resulted in 8 million hectares of land, 20% of Zimbabwe's area, moving to more than 160,000 small, inexperienced farm families. Many of the most profitable farms were given to important politicians and their families, including Mugabe's wife, Grace. None was an experienced agricultural expert. Recent studies have suggested agriculture is getting back to mid-1990s level. About 33% of new black farmers have become serious industrial-sized farmers. Mugabe's army ousted him from office in 2017. Emmerson Mnangagwa took power. For a short time, many thought he would lead Zimbabwe's recovery. But less than a year later, Mnangagwa ordered the military to act against activists who were protesting the country's election. Armed forces shot and killed six protesters. Whether we are talking about human rights or the economy, it is as if Mugabe never left. The only change has been for the worse, said Harare-based political expert Alexander Rusero. Life was not that good, but it was never this bad, said one man on the streets of Harare Friday morning. I'm Susan Shand.
A new Turkish law will subject internet broadcasters to the same rules as television and radio broadcasters. Critics say the new law is likely to lead to the same kind of government censorship that has affected Turkish broadcasters and newspapers. Online broadcasters will now come under the control of the Radio and Television Supreme Council, or RTUK. The government agency sets rules about content for the country's radio and television broadcasters. RTUK is controlled by allies of conservative President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Groups that watch international media say Erdogan already has strong control over the country's traditional news broadcasters. This has caused many well-known television or newspaper reporters who were forced out of their media jobs to join online operations. Yemen Akdeniz is a law professor at Istanbul's Bilgi University. He told VOA he thinks the new law is a government reaction to the increasing number of traditional broadcasters that have moved to the internet. Akdeniz said he fears the new rules will become yet another censorship tool for the government. Media expert Atale Yashilada works for the advisory group Global Source Partners. Erdogan realizes the media he controls is no longer watched or read in Turkey, he told VOA. 85% of Turkish households are now connected to the internet, and 70% of the youth generation get their entire information from social media and the internet, Yashilada said. The new rules require online broadcasters to request an RTUK license. any violations of RTUK rules can result in online broadcasters being blocked. The Turkish government already blocks an estimated 200,000 internet websites. This high level of censorship puts the country alongside nations like Iran and China. RTUK President Ebubekir Şahin said on Twitter that American-based Netflix has sought an RTUK license. He added that about 600 other organizations, including local online broadcasters, had also done so. Turkey is one of Netflix's fastest-growing markets. In 3 years, the service has gained 1.5 million subscribers, or about 10% of households. A Netflix spokesperson told The Hollywood Reporter its Turkish users value both the diversity of titles on Netflix and local storytelling. The spokesperson added, "While there have been concerns about some titles in the past, we have not been asked in Turkey to remove any content to date." Some question whether the new measures can be effective. Atale Yeşilada said the new law is technically impossible to enforce. "The main problem," he said, "is that it is very difficult for the government to silence critics and dissidents operating on the internet. If one website is blocked," he noted, "they can simply open a new one and announce it on social media. You have to shut down the entire social media, and that is totally unacceptable," Yeşilada said. It is not clear whether the new regulations will affect international news sites broadcasting online in Turkish. Agencies such as Britain's BBC, Germany's Deutsche Welle, France 24, and The Voice of America have stepped up their broadcasting in response to growing local demand. In April, the four agencies launched a joint site on YouTube to provide independent news content. Yaman Akdeniz has brought many lawsuits challenging internet controls in international courts. He said it remains unclear how the government will choose to use the new rules. But he does think it is possible that foreign news organizations could also be affected. I'm Brian Lynn.
The first thing Nima Vayazida does before starting work during American football season is inspect his fantasy football team. During the season, when players get hurt, you've got to change your lineup, add people from the waivers, he says. The 30-year-old Washington-based businessman says he takes up to an hour each day to consider and reconsider his team's players. Fantasy football is a game in which people create imaginary teams from among real players in the National Football League. Fantasy football team owners win points based on the performance of their players in real games. At the start of this season, most fantasy football participants give money to create a pot for his or her league. At the end of the season, the participants with the most points are awarded money from the pot. But fantasy team owners like Vayazida play for the right to hold their league's top prize, a championship trophy, for a year. The Fantasy Sports and Gaming Association estimates there are 59 million fantasy sports players in the United States and Canada. The group adds that the fantasy sports industry is worth more than $7 billion a year. Like many Americans, Fayezadeh has been playing fantasy football for years. And he does not just take part in one competition. This season, he is playing in 4 different fantasy leagues with high school friends, university friends, co-workers, and family members. Fayezadeh says his childhood dream was to head a sports team. "This is the closest I'll ever get to it, so it kind of makes me feel like I could put together a super team on my own and monitor that. But is that fun, costing U.S. businesses billions of dollars?" We're anticipating that fantasy football is going to cost employers this year around $9 billion in lost wages, notes Andrew Challenger. He says the money is being paid to unproductive office workers. They are participating in fantasy football activities when they normally would be working. Challenger is vice president of the outplacement service Challenger Gray and Christmas. It helps unemployed workers find new jobs. There is not a sure way to document employer losses, but Challenger estimates workers will spend 30 minutes daily during work hours studying their players, proposing trades, and doing related research. Challenger says that is not necessarily a bad thing, however. In fact, he thinks it would be a mistake for employers to restrict fantasy football in the workplace, where smartphones and social media already entertain workers. Fantasy football is one of those few areas that employers can insert themselves, Challenger says. They can start their own league, and it gets people within the office talking to each other, often people from different departments within your organization. "We feel like that's a really good investment for companies in terms of the culture of their organizations." Challenger himself has seen these results. His company supports an official fantasy football league. "We have a trophy that you get your name engraved on at the end of each season and get to keep that on your desk all year," he says. Fayezadeh's workplace does not operate an official fantasy football league, but he says members of the leadership team do take part in the office's fantasy league. Naturally, everyone wants to win, but for Fayezadeh, keeping in contact and interacting with old friends is as important. I'm Katie Weaver.
The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. Part 1.
Paris. It was in Paris during the summer of 1840. There and then, I met a strange and interesting young man named Auguste Dupin. Dupin was the last member of a well-known family, a family that had once been rich and famous. Auguste Dupin, however, was far from rich. He cared little about money. He had enough to buy necessities and a few books. That was all, just books. With books, he was happy. In fact, we first met in an old bookstore. A few more chance meetings at such stores followed. Soon, we began to talk. I was deeply interested in the family history, he told me. I was surprised, too, at how much and how widely he had read. More important, the force of his busy mind was like a bright light in my soul. I felt that the friendship of such a man would be for me riches without price. So I told him how I felt and asked him to come live with me. He would enjoy using my many fine books. And I would have the pleasure of company, for I was not happy alone. We passed the days reading, writing, and talking. But Dupin was a lover of the night. So often we walked the streets of Paris after dark. I soon noticed that Dupin had a special way of understanding people. Using it gave him great pleasure. He told me once, with a soft laugh, that he could see through the windows that most men have over their hearts. He could look into their souls. Then he surprised me by telling what he knew about my own soul. He knew things about me that I had thought only I could possibly know. At these times, he acted cold and emotionally distant. His eyes looked empty and far away. His voice became high and nervous. At such times, it seemed to me that I saw not just Dupin, but two Dupins. One who coldly put things together, and another who just as coldly took them apart. One night, we were walking down one of Paris's long, dirty streets. We were quiet, both busy with our own thoughts. But suddenly, Dupin spoke.
"You're right,"
he said.
"He is a very little fellow, that's true, and he would be more successful if he acted in lighter, less serious plays."
"Yes, there can be no doubt of that," I said. At first, I saw nothing strange in this. Dupin had agreed with me. This, of course, seemed to me quite natural. A few moments passed. Then it hit me. Dupin had not agreed with something I had said. He had agreed directly with my thoughts. I had not spoken a word. Dupin had read my mind. I stopped walking. "Dupin," I said, "Dupin, I don't understand. How could you know that I was thinking of..." Here I stopped speaking. If he really had heard my thoughts, he would have to prove it. And he did. He said,
"How did I know you were thinking of Shanti? You were thinking that Shanti is too small for the plays in which he acts."
"That is indeed what I was thinking. But tell me, in heaven's name, how did you know?"
"It was the fruit seller."
"Fruit seller?"
"I mean the man who bumped into you as we entered the street, maybe 15 minutes ago."
"Oh, yes, I remember now. A fruit seller with a large basket of apples bumped into me. But what does that have to do with you knowing I was thinking of Shanti?"
"I will explain. Listen closely now. Let us follow your thoughts from the fruit seller to the stage actor, Shanti. Those thoughts must have gone like this. Fruit seller to cobblestones, cobblestones to stereotomy, stereotomy to Epicurus, to Orion, and then to Shanti."
He continued,
"As we turned onto this street, the fruit seller bumped you. You stepped on some uneven cobblestones. I could see that it hurt your foot. You spoke a few angry words to yourself and continued walking. But you kept looking at the cobblestones in the street, so I knew you were thinking of them. Then we came to a small street where they are putting down new street stones. Here your face became brighter. You were looking at these more even stones, and your lips moved. I was sure they formed the word stereotomy, which is the name for how these new stones are cut. Stereotomy takes a large block and divides it evenly into smaller pieces. You will remember that we read about it in the newspaper only yesterday. I thought that the word stereotomy must make you think of the old Greek writer and thinker Epicurus. His ideas are also about dividing objects into smaller and smaller pieces called atoms. He argued that the world and everything else are made of these atoms. You and I were talking about Epicurus and his ideas, his atoms, recently. We were talking about how much those old ideas are like today's scientific study of the planets and stars. So I felt sure that now, as we walked, you would look up to the sky. And you did. I looked also at the sky. I saw that the group of stars we call Orion is very bright and clear tonight. I knew you would notice this and that you would think about the name Orion. Now keep listening carefully. Only yesterday, in the newspaper, there was a report about the actor Shanti. The critic did not praise him, and he used a Latin saying that had also been used to describe Orion. So I knew you would put together the two ideas of Orion and Shanti. I saw you smile, remembering the article and the mean words in it. Then I saw you straighten up, as tall as you could make yourself. I was sure you were thinking of Shanti's size, and especially his height. He is small, he is short, and so I spoke, saying that he is indeed a very little man, this Shanti, and he would be more successful if he acted in lighter, less serious plays.
I cannot say I was surprised by what Dupin had just reported. My reaction was much bigger than just surprise. I was astonished. Dupin was right as he could be. Those were, in fact, my thoughts, my unspoken thoughts, as my mind moved from one thought to the next. But if I was astonished by this, I would soon be more than astonished. One morning, this strangely interesting man showed me once again his unusual reasoning power. We heard that an old woman had been killed by unknown persons. The killer, or killers, had cut her head off and escaped into the night. Who was this killer, this murderer? The police had no answer. They had looked everywhere and found nothing that helped them. They did not know what to do next. And so they did nothing. But not Dupin. He knew what to do. That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.